This and other podcasts are available on the Gun Rights Radio Network, gunrightsradio.com. Podcasting freedom.
Well, he went down to dinner in his Sunday best. Excitable boy, they all said. And he put the pot roast all over his chest. Excitable boy, they all said. Well, he's just an excitable boy.
Hello, everybody. This is Bob Main, and you're listening to another episode of the Handgun World Show. The reason I carry a gun is because cops don't fit in my holster. You know what? That was emailed to me by a listener. He said I should use a different tagline, so I'll just try that for a while. Anyway, thanks for tuning in and downloading. This is a practical show. Why? Because I'm just a regular, average guy. I'm not a gunsmith. I'm not ex-law enforcement. I'm not ex-military. I'm not a firearms trainer. I'm just a guy that likes to shoot. It's my passion. It's my hobby. I am just a Yankee with a gun, like I like to call myself. I was born in New York City. I was raised in Wisconsin. Now I live in the great state of Texas, and I'm in sales for a living, so I travel around and talk to you about guns. And guess what? I'm not traveling today. I have the pleasure of doing this from my home office. I'm not talking to you from my car, as I often do. So today, I want to talk about some more shooting skills. I like to keep this show pretty much focused on how to become a better shooter. Self-defense shooter, competition shooter, whatever. I like to talk about self-defense ideas. I like to talk about competition ideas. I like to talk about how to maintain your guns and so forth, and what kind of training to take, and Second Amendment issues and things like that. That's pretty much the focus of my show, and I wanted to tell that to everybody who might be new tuning in, because there are some new people that are tuning in. I want to start off with some listener feedback first, and then I got another interview for you to hear again. But before I get into the listener feedback and stuff, I want to share with you something that a listener sent to me. Got a little joke here for you, a little gun humor. Now, I'm going to warn you, I'm not a comedian. All right, but this is kind of, I'll do my best here. It's called the Texas Road Stop. And since I live in the great Republic of Texas, those of you who are listening to me from Texas, you may get a little kick out of here, out of this this little joke here. The Texas Road Stop. A guy makes a rolling stop at a stop sign, and he gets pulled over by a local cop. The guy hands the cop his driver's license, insurance verification, plus his concealed carry permit. "Okay, Mr. Smith," the cop says, "I see your concealed carry permit. Are you carrying today?" "Yes, I am." "Well, then, you better tell me what you got." Mr. Smith says, "Well, let's see. Okay. I got a .357 Magnum revolver in my inside coat pocket. I got a 9mm semi-auto in the glove box. And let's see. Oh, yeah, I got a .22 Magnum Derringer in my right boot." "Okay," the cop says, "anything else?" Yeah, back in the trunk, there's an AR-15 and a shotgun. That's pretty much about it, sir." The cop says, "Mr. Smith, are you on your way to or from a gun range?" Mr. Smith says, "Nope." Cop says, "Well, then, what are you afraid of?" Mr. Smith says, "Not a damn thing." Okay, maybe I crashed and burned there as a comedian. I don't know. What do you think? I had to throw that in there because I can't say that I haven't been out there with more than one gun in my vehicle before. Can any of you relate to that? I have. I won't say what I carry in my vehicle, but I'll tell you this. I often, in fact, most of the time, have more than one firearm in my vehicle. By the way, what do you carry in your car? If you're not afraid to say it, go ahead and why don't you jump on the Gun Rights Radio Network forum and let us know. I think I'll start a thread asking you what do you carry in your car as a result of this show. Okay, I'll just go ahead and tell you. Well, I've always got my Glock 19 with me. I always carry that between the seat and the console, as I've mentioned before. I've always got some kind of a gun in my pocket, and quite often I've got a shotgun in the vehicle as well, in the trunk. So there's three of them right there. Okay, well, I put it out there in the public forum. I'll let you know what I'm carrying. But that's not all I own, so you never know, folks. Hey, bad guys out there, be careful. I might be changing up my armory a little bit in my mobile studio, which is oftentimes my vehicle. So, with that said, announcements. Real quick, the website, handgunworld.com. By the way, folks, I just put up a couple of new YouTube videos. Go to YouTube and search Handgun World Show and check out my YouTube videos. I just did one. Somebody emailed me, and they asked me if I would talk about the Glock 34 that I use for competition IDPA pistol shooting, so I did. I did a review of the Glock 34, the holsters, and the mag pouches that I use for IDPA competition. So check that out. Just search Handgun World Show on YouTube. Don't forget about my Facebook page at also Shooters Legion. That's kind of a cool networking site. I'm on there quite a bit. It's kind of like a Facebook for guns, and it's pretty cool. Last but not least, certainly don't forget about the Gun Rights Radio Network forums. There is a link in today's show notes on how to connect with me on the forum, and that's where I'll start the thread about what you're carrying in your vehicle. Okay. Let's get into a little bit of listener feedback. Now, I'm way behind, folks. I'm going to beg your forgiveness here. I'm way behind on getting to some of these, so sorry it's taking me so long. So I'm going to go back a couple of weeks here, and I'm going to start off with an email I got from a guy named Rick in Washington, state of Washington. I'm just going to read you the first sentence and a half here of this email because it says a lot. I like it. He says, Bob, I'm 53 and a former gun control advocate that grew up in a family with mixed feelings on the subject. Half were farmers and hunters, and half were city liberals, like myself. He says, about 2 years ago, right around the time the economy started tanking, something in me changed. I can't pinpoint it. Nothing bad happened to me to cause this change, but I guess you might say I saw the light. So, congratulations, Rick. Thanks for sending that in. It's a long email. He spends some good time talking about guns and about himself, but I just wanted to share that with you. I love stories like this. I like stories where, you know, people maybe were averse to guns. Maybe they weren't brought up around guns. And maybe they were brought up in environments like Rick. And when they see the light, when they come around towards the concept of defending oneself with a firearm and using the Second Amendment rights that are God-given rights to you in the Constitution, Rick, it warms my heart. It's why I do this podcast, is when I get feedback like this from people like you. So thanks again for sending that. Another guy named Mike, and by the way, Mike from Houston sent me an email recently, and I got a chance to, my last trip to Houston, I got a chance to meet Mike, and I had a little coffee with him over at a Starbucks, a gun-friendly place, Starbucks, right? That's why I chose to go there, and had a little coffee with him over there. We talked guns. We actually went to a gun store, perused around a little bit. So this is from Mike in Houston. He says he's been wanting to write to me and tell me how much he likes my show. Thank you, Mike. And he says he's recently downloaded most of my older shows, and competitive shooting is a new interest for him. And he says my genuine approach and my enthusiasm about the sport of shooting has got him interested in it. And looks like he's going to go shoot some IDPA. So, Mike, I tell you what, I didn't get a chance to talk about this with you when we had coffee the other day. But one of these days, I will schedule a business trip, and maybe I'll hang around in Houston over a weekend, and we can go shoot IDPA together. That'll give me a good excuse to go try a different club in a different range somewhere. Thanks, Mike, for sending that in. All right, this next email here comes from Trucker Bob. Trucker Bob writes in and says he's been listening to my show for about 6 or 7 months, and he likes it. Thank you, Trucker. I appreciate that. He says, I drive a truck and put about 130,000 miles a year in. Man, I tell you what, I thought I drove a lot, but I don't log 130,000 miles a year. So God bless you, Trucker Bob. And he says he listens to me while he's driving. Now don't get too distracted there, Trucker Bob. While you're listening to me, don't let me say something that makes you run off the road, okay? But he says he just recently started shooting action pistol matches back in May. And looks like he finished first in one of them. Congratulations. He shot his first IDPA match yesterday, so I guess some of the other pistol matches must not have been IDPA. He says he loved it. He came in fourth out of 15 shooters, and he says I'm a big reason why he was wanting to get into IDPA. So, well, you're welcome, Trucker Bob. I'm glad You know, like I said, these shooting sports. I'll say it because I'm going to say this again because somebody just recently sent me an email. And they blasted me because I talk so much about competition shooting. And this guy sends me an email, and I'm not going to mention his name because I don't want to in person kind of bring somebody down. But he says to me, "Oh, Bob, that competition stuff is not realistic. You know, combat training. As a matter of fact, sometimes it can teach you bad habits." Yes, I would agree with that. But let me tell you what, it can teach you a lot of good habits too. So I'm going to leave it up to you to figure out what are the bad habits and what are the good habits. Go get some good combat training. You know, go to a Masada U Group class. Go to a tactical response class. Go to a Suarez International class like I have been to. Go to Front Sight. Go to some places. Go take some courses from Rob Pincus and so forth. Get some good, solid combat training from a good quality instructor. And then figure out what to go practice on the competition range. But Trucker Bob makes a really good point here that I want to point out to you about right and left-handed shooting. You know, in the last episode, Steve and I were talking a lot about right and left-handed shooting. And Trucker Bob says to me, he says, this is a mindset and yet huge, if you stop to think about it. He says, where he shoots, they don't have strong or weak-handed shooting. He says, we have our shooting hand and our other shooting hand. No support hand or weak hand, it's called the other shooting hand. And the idea behind this is to practice with both hands and become combat efficient with each hand. Now, let me stop right there. You know what? This is a fantastic point. Trucker Bob, thanks for sending that in. As a matter of fact, you've now kind of convinced me to not call it my weak hand. It's now going to be my other shooting hand. You know, that's a really good point. You got one shooting hand, you got another shooting hand. You know, set a goal to be proficient with your other shooting hand, as good as you are with your regular shooting hand. That's a good mindset to put yourself in. Isn't that a good thing to practice? What do you think? Tell me, what do you think? Give me some comments and feedbacks. You know, I like to think that if we are in an altercation, that there may be a good chance that we might not have our primary shooting hand available. What if somebody's trying to wrestle you down to the ground, right? What if you got a couple people attacking you? What if they get the best of your strong hand? Whoops, there you go. I made a mistake. Uh-oh. What if they get the best of your regular shooting hand? You better be able to shoot with the other hand. Think about that. Trucker Bob says, when we call it strong hand, weak hand shooting, we set ourselves up for failure and that we give ourselves an out. Aha! Yes, he's right. I know what you're talking about there. I've done that. I've given myself an out when I use my left hand, because I'm a right-handed shooter. When I use my left hand, my other shooting hand, to shoot, yeah, it gives me an excuse to make excuses for bad shooting. It does. It's a reason to say, oh, yeah, well, you know, I messed that up because I was shooting it left-handed. Good point, Trucker Bob. Thanks for sending that in. I appreciate it. And thanks for driving that truck, putting all those miles on there. Obviously, there's something important that you're doing. Now, this next email comes from Brett. Brett emailed me a couple weeks back, said he lost his Glock magazine when he was doing dry firing practice. He couldn't figure it out. And he heard my shout out to him to have him update me as to whether he found his mag. So he says to me, he goes, Bob, I found my Glock magazine Christmas Eve. I was downstairs wrapping presents when I heard what could be described as a Glock mag being kicked around on a concrete floor. He says, I went to see what it was, and I found my cat playing with the Glock magazine in the laundry room. Apparently, he found it and claimed it as his new toy. So, Brett, hey, thanks for updating me on that. Just teach your cat to shoot and buy him a gun, and I think he'll be just fine. Thanks for sending that in, Brett. Now, Lawrence from Brazil emailed me. He's originally from Brazil. He's living here in the United States, but he has a little bit of a history on Taurus guns. He's a big Taurus fan, and he wanted to share some information with me because he heard me talking about Taurus guns. Now, folks, I know. There are some people that don't like Taurus guns. Have an open mind here, okay? For just a minute, have an open mind, because I got to be totally up front. I have seen a couple people now bring a Taurus 24/7 pistol to an IDPA match, and it ran just fine, folks, and it was plenty accurate. I know there's some guns that have problems, but hey, folks, all guns have problems. If somebody tells you they have a completely problem-free gun, you know what I think? If they have a problem-free gun, I think it means that they're not shooting enough. I really do. I think it means that they're just not out there going and shooting enough. Because if you shoot enough, if you train enough, you're going to have some problems with your gun. Or you're going to have some problems with your technique that's going to cause malfunctions in your gun. So anyway, I got off track, but here's a little history on Taurus. I won't make this too long, but it's kind of some cool stuff. He says Taurus produced its first revolver in 1941. I didn't know they were around that long. And began exporting its revolvers to the U.S. market in 1968. In 1970, the Banger Punta Corporation, then the parent company of Smith & Wesson, purchased 54% of Taurus, allowing the two firearms manufacturers to easily share information regarding design and manufacturing. In 1977, Taurus was purchased from Banger Punta by its current owners, and its ties to Smith & Wesson were severed. Now, see, I didn't know that. I never knew that Taurus had ties to Smith & Wesson. In 1980, after Italian arms manufacturer Beretta had completed its contracts to produce firearms for Brazil's military, Taurus purchased Beretta's Sao Paulo manufacturing plant, along with the tooling, technical drawings, and workforce necessary to produce several different pistol designs. And in order to more effectively tap into the U.S. market, the company created a subsidiary, Taurus International Manufacturing Incorporated, also known as Taurus USA, in 1984. Hey, Lawrence, thanks for sending that in. I did not know that. That's cool stuff. And good history there. I didn't know that Taurus had ties with Smith & Wesson. And I didn't know that they had purchased all that Beretta machinery and tooling and so forth. Have an open mind when it comes to Taurus guns, folks. That's all I want to say. Okay, the next email I want to cover, this is going to be the last of the listener feedback, but this is a great one sent to me. And I'm going to enjoy answering this one. This comes to me from Dave in Western Oregon. He says, Bob, you and the other podcasters talk a lot about training. What I like to hear from you is how much it actually costs, including time and money. Dave writes, if I look at taking a defensive handgun course at Thunder Ranch, for example, we're talking about $930 for the course, 800 rounds of ammo, and 3 nights lodging and meals. And he's figured it all out. He says by the time he pays for the course, the 800 rounds of ammo, the 3 nights lodging and the meals and everything, he guess he's looking at around $1,400 to $1,500. And that's not including the airline tickets because he says he can drive to it. So how does he justify that expense? And he also says, Bob, to be honest, you must know that I am not an adamant Second Amendment proponent. He says, I'm not fanatical about concealed carry. I believe it's the right of every law-abiding citizen, but I'm not convinced I need to do it every day. I'd like to say that I'm more of a hobbyist and enjoy shooting different firearms. Thus, I'd prefer to spend $600 on another gun than over $1,000 on 3 days training. Also, I think that competing in IDPA or IPSC gives me the opportunity to hone my gun handling skills. So he asks me, how do I justify the expense of training? Okay, Dave, $1,500, in my humble opinion, is a drop in the bucket to learn something that can save your life. I mean, I'm serious about that. Yeah, I understand you could go out and buy another gun, maybe two guns for that. But you know what? What good is that extra gun if you don't know how to properly use it? I'm not trying to sound like a smart aleck or anything. I'm really not. Thunder Ranch is a great school. It's a great place to go. Now, are there other courses for less money that you can learn just as much from? Sure. You know, I drive over to Tyler, Texas, and for $350, I take a Suarez International course. For me, Tyler, Texas is only about 100 miles from my home. Look around at some other schools possibly that might be closer, that might be having, you know, holding something closer, less money, maybe a little bit less round count. Maybe find a one-day class and take that 3 or 4 times until you hone your skills on that one-day class. Okay? But, boy, I would hate to see you, Dave. I'd hate to see you go drop the money on another gun. You say $600. Instead of $600 on that second gun or third gun, whatever it is, You could probably find near you, let's see, you're out in Western Oregon. If you search around the internet, I may even search for you and send you a couple of email links. I bet you for that same $600, you could get the course and half of your ammo paid for just for that $600. And you can probably find something closer to where you don't have to drive quite as far away and spend three full nights. You know, when I added up, I've got this class I can go to where Suarez does them in East Texas. When I added up, I spend $350 plus I spend another, I spent 800 rounds of 9mm. So, you know, that's probably around $180, $190, and two nights in a hotel. It's still worth it. It's worth it, Dave. Let me tell you what. You know, you say in your email that you don't believe that people need to carry every single day. Or at least you're not convinced that you need to carry it every day. Well, let me address that for a minute, Dave, that when you say that you're not, you know, convinced you need to carry it every day. And by the way, I really appreciate you sending me this comment. Because, you know, folks, if you have comments and you're not quite 100% on board with what I say, that's okay. I don't want everybody to agree with everything I say. Let me just share this with you, Dave. You say you may not have to, or you're not convinced that you have to carry every single day. What if you happen to get assaulted or attacked by some scumbag on the one day you're not carrying? And it's Murphy's Law, Dave. I mean, serious. It's Murphy's Law. You know what? The day you're going to get hit is the day you're not carrying your gun. Sure enough, right? That's when it's going to happen. And you know the old saying, I'd rather have it and not need it than to need it and not have it. What if you need it and you don't have it? What if you're with family, Dave, and you guys get attacked and you have family members in danger? That's the one day you picked not to carry your pistol. How would you feel? I tell you what, folks, the reason I always carry is I can't live with myself if something happens to a family member and I wasn't prepared to handle that situation. If a family member of mine is getting attacked, if it's my wife or it's my son, and I wasn't armed, I wasn't ready to do something about it, at least try. Even if I'm not successful, I tried. And maybe I made the situation a lot better than it could have been because I was able to draw my gun and use it if I have to. Again, folks, as a last resort, I understand that using your gun needs to be a last resort. Please don't think that I get on this podcast and talk to you about going out and killing people and I'm not a trigger-happy maniac, okay? That's not what I am. But I do believe that danger exists out there. And sure enough, the one day that I walk out of my house without a gun, that's going to be the day I get hit. That's my case, Dave. Take it for what it's worth. But Dave in Western Oregon, thank you very much for sending me this. I think training is far a better investment than going and buying another gun. Learn how to be effective with that gun. You know what else training does, folks? And Dave, and to everybody else listening out there, here's something I never talked about on this podcast before. Firearms training also teaches you more than just how to use your gun. It teaches you mindset. Think about that. It teaches you the mindset. And a good course teaches you how to avoid confrontation. A good trainer worth their salt is going to teach you how to avoid confrontation. Okay? They're going to teach you how to keep yourself out of a lot of gunfights as well. So look for a course that teaches you two things: how to stay out of a gunfight and what to do if you get in one. That's all I'll say about that. And so that's going to conclude the listener feedback. So thanks for tuning in to segment number one. You're going to hear a little bit of a break coming up. But in the second segment, guess what? I've got my buddy Steve Zofi back on for part number two. Now, once a month, we like to get together and talk about shooting skills in Brian Enos's book, Practical Shooting Beyond Fundamentals. The reason you're hearing this for the second time this month is because it was such a great interview and it was a lengthy interview. I had to kind of break it up into two different segments. So last week I played the first segment. Here's the second segment. Steve and I get into a lot of good practical shooting ideas and tips. And we always do our best to take this practical shooting stuff and we like to give it a self-defense application and talk about how you can use it in self-defense. So, by the way, Dave, in Western Oregon, yes, Training classes give you good, competition gives you good gun handling skills, but competition shooting can't give you some of the mindset training that a lot of good firearms courses give you. I'll leave it at that. So, 15-second break, folks, and on the backside of the break, you're going to hear Steve and I talking quite a bit about practical shooting. By the way, you may hear a little bit of a commercial here for the gunfacts.info and the Gun Rights Radio Network. Catch you on the other side of the break.
A woman is approximately 10 times more likely to be successfully raped when she doesn't have a gun, according to a Department of Justice study. This explains why women in the United States use firearms about 200,000 times a year to stop sexual assaults. It also explains why more than 40% of women own or already have access to a firearm. So why do some politicians want to disarm women? Maybe rape isn't a serious enough crime in their minds. Or maybe they don't want to stare down the wrong end of your barrel.
Arm yourself with facts to strip the gun control industry bare. Visit gunfacts.info and get your free copy of Gun Facts. Called Indispensable by Cam Edwards of NRA News, Gun Facts is your rapid reference guide to debunking gun control myths and shaming politicians into obedience. www.gunfacts.info.
Okay, well, for the main topic of this show, just like last week, I got Steve Zoffi back on to finish up talking about Chapter 4 of Brian Enos' book, Practical Shooting Beyond Fundamentals. How you doing, Steve?
Very good, Bob. How are you doing?
Well, good, good. Thanks for the last show. And, I just want to let all the listeners know right up front, if this sounds a little bit choppy at times, it's because we're actually going to record this in short segments because we've been having a few internet challenges lately.
Yes, we have.
But I'm pretty good at splicing these interviews together, so I'm just going to let all the listeners beware of that. So let's continue on with Chapter 4 in the book, and I think last time we left off right before talking about, was it
single-handed shooting. So just to bring everybody back up to speed, this chapter's specific challenges, and the idea here is basically that during your shooting, at some point you're going to run into courses of fire and whatnot that are going to incorporate something that you're not something that you're normally used to. So it's kind of like the oddball stuff that you run into stages that you don't really go out and practice all the time. And the idea is that you go out and practice these things and become proficient at them so that when you are called on demand to do them, you don't really have to think the process through of how do I do this or how to do that. You've just done it before and you know automatically how to do it. So that's what this whole entire chapter is about.
Okay.
So single-handed shooting, also known as either strong-hand or weak-handed shooting, during courses of fire, either by definition of the course of fire where they require that you either shoot strong hand or weak hand, or a course of fire where they have you manipulate a prop, let's say it's a briefcase or a bag that you got to carry or something like that, you're going to run into strong hand, weak hand shooting. Mm-hmm. And Brian talks basically about two kind of stances that he uses for we'll just call it one-handed shooting. And the two different stances are either quartering away from the target, your traditional, bullseye stance where you quarter off to the target and extend your arm out pretty much in line to the target. Or the other one that he talks about is kind of a almost the same stance that you would shoot if you were shooting freestyle with your traditional two-hand grip on the gun, but now we're just using a one-hand grip. So in this case, you're pretty much your body's perpendicular to the target and facing straight on. And he kind of says that he changes from one to the other depending on whether it's a accuracy intensive shot where a fair amount of high accuracy is required, or if it's, let's say, at a long distance or something like that, versus an easier shot, or maybe one that might require a reload after you shoot. And for this difficult shot, he'll quarter away, or he recommends quartering away, like your traditional bullseye stance. And for the easier, maybe closer up shot, more wide open target, or something where you'd immediately be doing a reload, he likes using the freestyle approach. Myself, I have rotator cuff damage in my right shoulder, and I have found that if I adopt the traditional quartering stance that you would use for bullseye, that the strain in my right shoulder is nearly unbearable to the point that it's pretty painful. So because of that, I have pretty much adopted the freestyle stance where I'm perpendicular or using my normal freestyle stance pretty much for all strong hand or weak hand shooting. From my standpoint of just, you know, trying to minimize the pain.
I hear you on the pain of rotator cuff. I have the same problem. I've had rotator cuff surgery about 3 years ago.
Yeah, I have not had anything done yet, and I tried to, you know, tackle it by just doing the different various exercises and things. And sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, but I just found from a standpoint of shooting that, you know, it literally just takes a couple degrees angle of your body to, you know, where it's either in pain or not in pain. So I've kind of just used a standard, you know, freestyle approach for any and all shooting. So the other thing that's really key, and probably everybody's heard this, but I'll just repeat it again in single-handed shooting, is you want to anchor, you know, your non-shooting hand or whatever against your body, against your chest somewhere, just so it's not out flailing around behind you, because it acts as a counterbalance, and anything that you do with your, you know, offhand while you're shooting, it's going to steer your body, and that's something you don't want to do.
Anchor your non-shooting hand where?
Anywhere against your body. So, you know, you may want to, what I typically do is I pull it across my chest and make a fist and literally put it to my chest. Some people will put it at their hip or at their side or at their waist or at their stomach or something like that. But I just basically bring center of mass in, put it at my chest, and extend my strong.
That's exactly hand. What I do too. Mm-hmm. I usually have the fist right over pretty much about where my heart is.
Exactly. Then, that's same thing I do.
Yeah.
So that's strong hand shooting, and the other half of this is your weak hand shooting. And you and I have kind of talked about this before, but again, in weak hand shooting, your options are either quartering away to the target or using, again, a freestyle approach. The thing that I found that's really helpful in weak hand shooting is canting the gun inward, inward toward your body as opposed to outward, slightly to the point of maybe about 20 to 30 degrees or so, give or take.
Yeah, I do that.
And that does two things, and you probably notice this also in that, and you can kind of prove it to yourself, but by canting it in, it really aligns the bones and your joints in your arm, and also eliminates a lot of the muscle tension that you normally would experience if you hold the gun straight up or perpendicular to the ground.
I have noticed that. As a matter of fact, not only is it more comfortable that way, but it reduces recoil, seems like.
Yeah, right, because the recoil is your wrist is in line with your arm, and the recoil comes straight back. If you crank your wrist straight up, it generates an angle there because you're trying to pull the gun over to your shooting eye.
Yeah.
And by doing that, your wrist is broken at an angle, and it really makes it easy for the recoil to have a leverage point on your wrist. And I found that just by simply, like we're saying here, just rotating the gun in and keeping everything in a straight line, that it eliminates recoil quite a bit. The other thing, like we talked before about muscle tension or tension in your forearms and your shoulders, that by doing that, it eliminates tension, and the gun just seems to recoil a lot more consistently, as opposed to when you have tension where it kind of like will hunt around or bob or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the other advantage of this is that it rotates the gun into your dominant eye. So in my case, I'm right eye dominant, and when I'm shooting weak-handed or left-handed, by canting the gun, it rotates the sights.
Brings it right in there, doesn't it?
Right in line with my right or my strong dominant eye. So that's the other advantage of doing this. And those two things together, I think, really make, you know, weak hand shooting, I'm not going to say easy, but it's, you know, it sure simplifies the process quite a bit. The other challenge is when you have to do the transfer from the strong hand to the weak hand, and typically going to weak hand, I mean, they never allow us to draw the gun with the weak hand. You've got to draw it with a strong hand and then transfer it. And I don't know in IDPA if they'll have you start with a gun in your hand in the weak hand, or if they have you draw and transfer. But in USPSA, it's always draw and transfer. We never start with the gun in the hand ever on a course of fire.
Yeah, I can partially answer that. In IDPA, there are stages, I've shot plenty of them, where you do start with the gun in your weak hand at the low ready position.
Right.
There are some that do that. There are others that will typically have you draw with the strong hand, shoot strong hand only, then transfer the gun to your weak hand and shoot weak handed only.
Right, right.
And those are about the only two scenarios involving weak handed shooting that I can recall in IDPA.
Yeah, have you, I mean, in IDPA, have you shot stages where you have to manipulate a prop, you know, a briefcase bag or something like that?
Yes.
Like, yeah.
Yes, and typically for safety purposes, what they tell us there is if we have to pick up like a briefcase, they tell us to do that first before we draw our gun.
Right, right.
You know, pick up the case first, then draw your gun with your strong hand, then move into shooting position and so forth. Sometimes we're opening up a door. Sometimes we have to reach over, turn the doorknob, hold the door open with your foot, then draw, and then start shooting.
Yeah, just I'm glad you mentioned that. I had one other thought I was going to comment on here, which I'll try to remember, but your comment about opening a door is that's something that people really need to be who have not done this before but really need to be careful about doing this, is that unfortunately there's a tendency of pointing the gun at whatever you look at. And if you look at the doorknob and you open the doorknob with your, you know, weak hand, a lot of people will point the gun at what they're looking at and they'll end up sweeping themselves or pointing it at their hand or something like that. So.
Ooh, good point. I didn't think about that.
Yeah. So I consciously, whenever we run into a stage like that where you have to, you know, push a port open with your hand or open a door up or something like that, I will consciously force that gun off to the side. To make sure that it is nowhere near where my hand is, because in both sports, if you sweep yourself, it's the automatic DQ, which we don't want. So this is just it's a safety point there.
Yeah. Now let me ask you a question. Don't you think that's also just good practice to ingrain in your head in case you ever have to use that technique in real life?
Definitely. Yeah. And it gets into, you know, the second rule of gun handling, of never pointing the gun at anything you're not willing to destroy. So, you know, again, it just falls in line there. But yeah, in terms of just, you know, sound tactics and things like that, you definitely don't want to, you know, be pointing the gun at your body in any way, shape or form by, you know, whenever you're doing any, you know, clearance drills or whatever you may be doing.
Yeah, here's another one for you. What I've done, what I've been practicing on lately, tell me what you think of this. If we have to start with our strong hand, what I'll do is I'll draw and I'll go with the strong hand. And then when I transfer to the weak hand, I sometimes also transfer my weight a little bit to my weak side leg.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I've not consciously, you know, paid attention to what I'm doing there. So I may end up doing that and I don't really realize it. A lot of times what will happen is for a traditional strong hand shooting position, you're probably, if you're not quartering, you may have your right foot slightly more forward of your left foot, but it's quite close to a traditional quartering stance. And then if you do the transfer, typically what you do is you shift your feet, so all of a sudden your left foot is now forward of your right foot. And by doing that, yeah, you'll probably end up putting more weight on. It's kind of like, you know, leaning into the target, so to speak, and then you will put your weight on your forward leg. And in this case, when you're doing the transfer, it will be your left foot.
Yeah, same type of concept. Okay,
right.
Let's continue.
So one thing I was thinking about here, just as a comment, is that when you do that transfer, there's a couple different techniques, but typically I use what's called the wipe technique, where, you know, you're standing there, your strong hand is in a normal traditional, you know, fully encompassing grip on the gun. You bring your weak hand grip, I'm sorry, your weak hand up to the gun as if you were achieving your standard two-handed position, but as the weak hand comes in, it kind of basically comes up and over, or wrapping around the back of your strong hand. And then you kind of like wipe your strong hand away from the gun as your weak hand then basically, adopts the grip, to the gun, to fully, fully and grip from the gun. So the other thing I was going to comment on about when I was asking you about manipulating props is I've seen a lot of people get, at least it seems like in USPSA, is everybody is trying to come up with this gamey thing of thinking about how they can still have their two-handed grip on the gun but manipulate the prop at the same time. And I've seen people, particularly like with briefcases or things like that, where they try to hold the briefcase with the hand but adopt or still maintain the two-hand grip on the gun. And that's really bad, because what happens is that no matter what you do, nobody can stabilize that briefcase to the point that it stops it from swinging. And the thing will just, you know, swing back and forth a little bit. And you're hanging that briefcase out there along with your gun, trying to hold all of it together at the same time. And it just ends up steering the gun left and right. And sometimes the best thing to do is just, you know, probably always the best thing to do is just use a strong hand or weak hand to do the shooting. And, you know, whatever you're trying to carry, just bury it against your body. The same idea that we were talking about earlier, planting your non-shooting hand against your body will plant that, you know, proper whatever it is against your body and just keep it from moving around from steering
the gun
in your other hand, so your shooting hand.
Good point.
Okay.
So that covers weak hand and strong hand shooting.
Right, right.
Okay.
So
before we move on, let me put this in there. To everybody who's listening to this, you need to practice this. You need to practice strong hand and weak hand a lot, because I'm a firm believer in this. You know, people have heard me say so many times that the reason I compete is not so much to get out there to win, but just to get better with my gun handling skills and get better at what I do and become a better shooter and feel more confident about being able to defend myself. So given the fact that I just said that, you could find yourself in a position to where you're only going to have a strong hand and possibly only a weak hand to use to defend yourself.
Right, definitely.
With a firearm.
Right, and the other thing I would really recommend is that when you do take training classes, and you have been through this and I have been through this, but part of the training classes is learning how to run the gun completely with either your strong hand or your weak hand. So doing reloads, doing draws from the opposite side, so to speak, you know, failure drills, everything. It's, you know, very critical that you do learn how to shoot and run the gun with only one hand should, you know, the situation arise.
Yeah, and for those of you who have not been to a good training class, any training class worth its salt is going to make you practice strong hand and weak hand. So you might as well go out to IDPA or IPSC and start practicing that.
You'll at least get the shooting part of it down. You aren't going to be able to do the you know, the reload with a single hand or drawing with, I'm sorry, doing a cross draw, so to speak, with a single hand, or failure drills or anything like that, because both sports just prohibit that just from a safety standpoint. But you will at least get the shooting part of it down on strong hand, weak hand in either or game.
Yeah, good.
So the next section here is shooting prone and kneeling. There's probably nothing any competition shooter hates worse than going prone.
I don't like it at all.
Yeah, and I don't either. I absolutely hate going prone. In fact, when we do our IPSC 101 classes where we're taking a bunch of new shooters and introducing them to USPSA or IPSC shooting, you know, we try to do these demonstrations for them, and it's just part of the class I just don't like doing is the prone demonstration, because just of the fact that you're throwing yourself down on the ground there, and especially if it's been raining or something like that, which it does typically up here in the Northwest. In fact, today it snowed.
Lucky you.
Yeah, we had about 3 or 4 inches of snow. But at any rate, so it's just not very fun to go off and do that. But Brian outlines two different techniques for going prone. I'll offer a suggestion of a third technique here after I talk about his first two. But the primary thing on going prone is to draw the gun before you even begin your movement or your motion toward the ground, for obvious reasons, because if you start as you're going down, or even worse, if you do it once you're down on the ground, you're pointing the gun behind you, and that action there alone will again be a safety violation and get the shooter DQ'd in either game. But the technique that he talks about, or the two, is that the first one is that you draw the gun and the weak hand goes to the ground, and the right leg or the opposite side leg will extend backward, and the left leg, and I'm doing this all from a strong-handed right-handed or strong right-handed shooter's perspective, then kind of bends, and you kind of look like a track athlete in a launch position, so to speak, as you're going down. Brian, I think, says he prefers this method because he says he kind of feels like he floats down toward the ground when you do this. The problem for me is that it's just the whole entire thing about thinking about, okay, sending my leg, bending my left leg, putting this down, da-da-da-da-da. It's just, to me, it's too much mentally for me to think through the whole entire process. And I've tried doing it, and honestly, if I probably dedicated myself to doing that, I could probably perfect the technique. But again, I hate going prone of throwing yourself down there on the ground. So it's not something I really practice a lot. So I'm not a real big fan of that technique. The second technique, unfortunately, hurts a lot more or has a potential for hurting a lot more, but it's an easier one for me to do. And basically, your feet stay together. You kind of lean forward. Your weak hand goes down, just like in the first technique. But you shoot your feet straight back, which means for a moment, basically the only contact between you and the ground is your weak hand.
You're airborne
for a brief moment. And of course, anything that's in the air eventually comes crashing down to earth. And in this case, that's you. And you slam into the ground. And I have seen people literally knock the wind out of them, when they come down and hit. So, at any rate, that's the technique that I use. And it does result in a pretty severe impact when you hit the ground. But, it's just the one that I can, you know, mentally work myself through.
Okay.
Now, the third technique is one that I've seen done, and it's a little less intrusive than either of them, is that you actually come forward into a full kneeling position on both knees. So you literally, you're standing there and just drop to both knees as you're drawing. And so you're literally now in a kneeling position, and then you just stick your weak hand forward and kind of, you know, slide yourself down onto the ground and get into a prone shooting position that way. So those are the three techniques that I'm aware of. Now, the next issue is that, and again, talking about my problem with rotator cuff problems, is once you get down into the prone position, because of the rotator cuff damage that I have in my right shoulder, I cannot extend, especially when I'm down on the ground, I cannot extend both arms out. I end up in severe pain by doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing is that when you shoot prone, you want to basically have full contact with the ground. You don't want the gun to be floating up in the air, because doing so, the recoil will, you know, move the gun quite a bit. It's really an unnatural shooting position. So they recommend that you ground the gun, so to speak, or ground it. And what I mean by that is basically, you know, place the gun on the ground. And in this case, you want to do it on the heel or butt of the gun, of the pistol or the revolver that you're shooting.
Okay.
And maintain contact that way. Now, some people don't recommend that because they suggest that putting pressure on the magazine may induce feed failures because it might push the magazine slightly further up into the gun than what it normally would do. I've never actually seen that problem happen, so I can't comment on that, but I have heard it mentioned that it potentially can happen. So getting back to what I do, because of the fact that I can't adopt your traditional prone position of your body in line with the targets, I quarter myself off to the targets. I put my right shoulder down on the ground. My bicep is in contact with the ground. My left elbow and pretty much my forearm is in contact with the ground. But by doing this, I have my arm canted slightly at an angle. So my cheek of my, my cheek of my face, obviously. My cheek is, what other cheek would I be talking about?
Yeah, well, I don't know.
Well,
what other cheek would you...
Actually, it's in contact with the ground, too, now that I think about it. But at any rate.
Well, this time your other cheeks will be in contact,
yes. Yeah, my cheek of my face is in contact with my bicep, and my head is at an angle. And the gun is also at an angle. So there's a consideration here of depending on the distance that you're shooting, but... obviously when you sight a gun in, you're sighting into the point of impact, and when you shoot, we sight in with the gun vertical. So the bullet goes up and the bullet comes down due to gravity, and it just happens to land perfectly right at the top of your sight, or at least depending on if you're sighted in, that's the way it goes. When you turn the gun sideways, all of a sudden the gravity vector is in a different direction than what it was when you sighted the gun in. So by doing this, the bullet's going to, if you're tilting the gun to the right, the bullet's going to go basically further to the right than what you think it normally would. It's not going to be at the tip of the sight where it's going to impact. It's going to be somewhat to the right at the top of the sight, and then it's going to drop from there. So it's just something that you need to take into consideration if you do use this style of shooting. If you cant the gun slightly, the bullet impact may not be exactly where it normally would be if you were shooting vertical. Now, the faster the bullet is going, the less of a effect this has, because your distance or your time to target is obviously a lot shorter with a fast bullet versus a slow bullet. So for the shooters who are shooting, say, 45 caliber ACP, and the bullets, you know, lumbering along at 700 feet per second, they're going to see more of an effect of this than your either 9mm shooter or somebody shooting open or whatever, where the bullet might be zipping along at over, you know, 1,000 feet per second. So it's just something to keep in mind.
Okay.
And in terms of kneeling, there's two techniques for going down for kneeling. And one, actually, I never knew about the second technique until I saw it demonstrated by Matt Burkett. But kneeling, most people do this, they step forward and go down and kneel. It's, you know, you're standing there, you draw the gun, you step forward, and you come down on your right knee. The problem is that when you do that is that when you come down and contact the ground with your knee, the gun's going to bounce, and there's almost no way of trying to slow the movement going down when you make contact with the ground by when you step forward. I mean, it's kind of like your momentum's going forward, and you can't really do anything about it. Mm-hmm. The technique that Burkett likes to show is that rather than stepping forward from the start position, you pretty much put all of your weight on your in this case, my left leg. So I'm like almost floating on my right leg. And instead of stepping forward, you literally just drop straight down. And you can, by doing this, you can really regulate or adjust or slow or whatever you want to call it when you come into contact with the ground so you don't get the bounce that you normally would get. So I know this probably kind of sounds weird to envision what I'm talking about, but
yeah, I can't envision it.
Well, think of it this way. If you're putting all your weight in your left leg and just lift your right leg, you're going to tip to the right, basically what happens.
Yeah,
okay.
That's true.
So what happens is that you are putting all your weight on your left leg, you lift your right leg and then bend your left knee. And you're going literally straight down at this point, and that's what I'm talking about. Okay. You go straight down and your right knee, you can kind of really adjust your drop speed with the muscles in your left leg as you come into contact with the ground, and it just minimizes the bump that you hit when you go into the ground. But that's really all there is to kneeling, nothing too fancy. Brian talks briefly about kneeling on where your butt is basically against both you're basically kneeling on both knees and your butt is in contact with the heels of your feet. Rarely do we really do that because from the standpoint that it takes a long time to get into that position and it takes a very long time to get out of that position.
Yeah. It does.
Yeah. And usually we'll find some other technique to try to, you know, replace that with if we can.
I found it hard to get out of the position.
It is.
Yeah.
It's not an easy one to get into or especially get out of. No. Now, if it's the last, let's say it's the last shooting position and of course the fire's out like that and you don't have to get out of it, then it may work out well for you. So let's say you're going into a very low port and you decide to use this very low port. It's the last shooting position of the stage, assuming that you have that option to pick and choose, you know, where you're going to go and how you're going to shoot something. But that might be something you can say, oh, I know I got to go to this port last and I want to, you know, I can kneel down on both knees and sit back, so to speak, and make use of it. Because by the time I'm done, I fire my last round, I'm effectively off the clock at that point when I'm doing, you know, standing back up.